part of the Pegasus Committee, Helen, that after we should get the committee spend some few minutes just to get an update report on the establishment of the budget office and process that was communicated in another slide. So I thought I should just get to one of the members. But for the purpose of you being here, it's the agenda. Roy, what's your name? You are welcome. You're Lena. Some members of the lobby are going to discuss one of our drawings with the Minister of Health. I'm going to have an afternoon. Honorable Ross also, the viewer has been honored this work.
Review. so that each of them gets reviewed over a 5-year process, and they bring them to this committee and to the House for update. And this is now the Term of Banks Act, which, as I said, was last amended in 2007. And so it is due now for its 5-year update and upgrade. And there have been a number of external developments which have obviously informed the review process over the last number of years. These external developments include a Basel Committee on Banking Supervision Core Principles. What has happened there is that during the global financial crisis, a number of new committees were set up. The G20, obviously, Finance Ministers and Governors process, the G20 Heads of State process, and then the Financial Stability Board process. And these all inform the Basel Committee on Bank Supervision's proposals to upgrade and improve the regulation of the banking system. And so these have brought about two major pieces of regulatory change in the second bullet, which is Basel 2.5, which is basically an update to the global regulatory system of banking supervision, and then Basel 3, which is a more significant update. So that has been a process that has been taking place over the last number of years. Then there have been assessments by the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the Financial Action Task Force. We have a Financial Stability Assessment Program, which is a program led by the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank, which has come to us twice in the last 5 years. They came to us in 2008 and 2010, and they did quite a comprehensive assessment of our financial system of regulation. So they looked at how we've implemented banking supervision, security supervision, and insurance supervision. And overall, we had a very, very positive assessment. They were very impressed with the quality of our system of financial supervision. And we take them seriously because, as you know, we were only one of 3 or 4 G20 countries that didn't have a financial crisis. However, these assessments have highlighted some small gaps in our legislation and our regulatory framework, and these require some changes to our law, and these are included in the bank's amendment that we're bringing to you today. Then there was a securitization review undertaken by, I think, Bank Supervision, a review board process. They've obviously been King 3, so King, Mervyn King has led a process to look at corporate governance, large financial, and well, actually all corporate institutions, and those obviously inform corporate governance principles for banks. Then there's been a financial crisis, as I said, and then obviously quite a significant piece of new legislation, which is the Companies Act of 2008, which has come into force, I think, in 2010. So there have been quite a lot of things obviously happening in the financial sector in the last 5 years. It's been one of the busiest periods of our, I think, probably historically in terms of what's been going on. And these are all the kinds of things that we have included in this amendment law. In terms of process, as I said, we have been busy for the past 2 years. Michael has been leading this process on behalf of the Reserve Bank, and Treasury has been a very close part of it. There is something called Standing Committee on Revision of the Bank Act, which is a requirement of the law, which has to sit, and they sit about 4 times a year, if I'm correct. And what they do is it's a very high-level committee consisting of a representative from, for example, the audit profession, and there the representative is the CEO of Deloitte, or the chairman of Deloitte, if I'm correct. As it sells, it's Bakhtar, isn't it? And quite a number of very high-profile, high-level individuals, which is a process, a very useful process for the minister because it assists us when we develop the banks and minimal to record new pieces of legislation. So Michael has been providing this committee with high-level briefings, and the first draft was submitted to the committee in 2010 already, and then there's been quite a long process, and given you all the data over the last few years. Finally, draft 8 was finalized on 16th of May 2012, and that was then submitted to the minister. The final draft was submitted to the minister. I don't think there's any changes since that draft, and that draft was tabled in the draft that you see today. So there's been quite an extensive consultation with industry, and then the bill was gazetted at the end of last year. So I just give you a quick background to how we got to you today. It's been a long process, but we are very happy to be here. So we're quite pleased that this bill is now seeing the light of day. So I can pause now and take questions, and then I can continue getting the little guidance shared. Okay, so if you have a look at the bank's amendment bill, you'll see that it is, as with all of our bills, unfortunately, it doesn't make anybody's life a lot any easier. It is arranged sequentially from every section that we're amending in order from one to another section there are. So what we've done to assist the committee and actually to assist ourselves in the process is on this matrix I have reorganized the amendments and categorized them by the type of amendment that we're undertaking, similar to how we've done the financial services general rules amendment. And so I will take you through each category. Then I will highlight which sections that you will find in the bank's amendment bill have been amended as a result. So the first set of changes which have had to be made to the Banks Act relates to specific definitions that are required for Basel III purposes. And this is because Basel III changes certain types of capital requirements for banks. And so we've had to introduce a set of five new definitions, which are additional Tier 1 capital, unimpaired reserve funds, common equity Tier 1 capital, unimpaired reserve funds, Tier 2 capital or unimpaired reserve funds, Level 1 high quality liquid assets, and Level 2 high quality liquid assets. And those are definitions in the definition section of the Banks Act, and they affect Section 70, 70A, 72 and 79 of the Banks Act. So you will find them in the definitions, and then you will find them also in that relevant part of the Banks Act. The second set of changes to the Banks Act, this is probably the most extensive set of changes, but it makes almost no difference, I think, to the operation of the Act, but quite important for us to do because we have to keep all the pieces of legislation aligned with one another. And that is obviously the New Companies Act of 2008, which was Act 71 of 2008, which came into effect in May 2010, requires us to make the changes. So on the left-hand column, we've given you what the original definition was in the Banks Act. And referred to 1973 Act, and now we've updated it to refer to the new Act. And that just requires quite a lot of changes in terminology. So, for example, we need to introduce the concept of a commission, which is now the Companies Intellectual Property Commission, the Commissioner, Companies Act, Control, and Director, to align with the Companies Act. Similarly with domestic shareholder, financial statements, holding company, public company, and then obviously all the references to registrar of company, companies is commissioner, subsidiary, and subsidiary. And then the next sections, we've highlighted where in the piece of legislation this has had to take place. So these are now all the references to 1973 Companies Act, which are not repealed, which relate to Section 1, Section 60, and Section 68, and Section 84. Then, as I said, we have to replace Register of Companies with Commissioner. That's in Section 15, Section 51, Section 54, Section 56, 57, and 65. So on the left-hand side, we've given you an example of the text that you will see in the Banks Amendment. And then the Companies Act introduces this concept of memorandum of incorporation, which replaces what used to be called memorandum of association and articles of association, and it's a slightly different concept, but that doesn't mean that the Banks Act has to change, and there we've listed where in the Banks Act that needs to change. So that's in 15, 16, 17, quite a number of different places. And then we obviously, the parts of the Banks Act refer to parts of the Companies Act. And so we've had to just ensure that the correct chapter references are contained in the Companies Act. Oh, sorry, in the Banks Act. So that the Companies Act references are correct in the Banks Act. Now on page 5 in the middle, these are also particular changes to references. I don't think I should go through this in too much detail, but we've tried to explain exactly what we've had to do in each of those places. So obviously, as the law works, is every time there has to be a change, there has to be something recorded in the Banks Amendment Bill itself, so that makes it look very long and actually takes not that long. And so forth. Then there's the Section 27 change, which requires special resolution in terms of the Companies Act, and there again the Banks Act needs to be updated to deal with that. Then the provisions of the Sections 128 to 155 of the Companies Act related to business rescue. Banks obviously have a slightly different system in terms of how business rescue is dealt with. There are quite extensive provisions in Section 68 and 69 of the Banks Act, which have been quite successful in dealing with a number of bank wind-ups, particularly Samba, which I think was a Section 69 curatorship. And so we just highlighting that banks are already covered under that part of the law. And then there has been one which has been particularly contentious, has caused us quite a lot of entertainment, I think, at the Treasury, which is that the Companies Act prohibits a reference to a director unless the person is actually on the board of directors. And some banks call some of their relatively senior personnel directors, and unfortunately we now have to make that legal. And so people have now lost the title of director. And they have now, I think, been called general managers. So that has been remarkably contentious, but it's just a small change in title. So that has had to change. And then obviously there's some issues around the audit committee, which has had to change. So I think that deals with all the Companies Act provisions. Then there have been quite a lot of other things taking place over the last few years in terms of other pieces of legislation. One has been we have replaced the Public Investment Commissioners Act of 1984 with the Public Investment Corporation Act of 2004, and we've also replaced the Unit Trust Control Act of 1981 with the Collective Investment Schemes Control Act of 2002, and so as a result, the bank sectors have to be updated to reflect that. And then, similarly, as you know, we have replaced, actually, the Stock Exchanges Control Act of 1985. That has been changed to the Financial Markets Act of 2012. The current draft of the bill still refers to the Securities Services Act, and that is just a consequence of when the bill was tabled. It was tabled before the Financial Markets Act was passed. But that doesn't make much difference. We'll make those changes in the next draft. We'll explain when we've done that. And then, yes, it's also been changed to the Public Accountants and Auditors Board to Independent Regulatory Board for Auditors. And then there's quite a few tidying up of existing provisions. We just would like to introduce representative officers into where the registrar can create circulars and directives. And then similarly, we thought we would update this very old-fashioned language from the Minister Solaire upon the tables to the Minister Solaire of Public Report in Parliament, because I think that makes more sense. And then we've also changed controlling company reference to holding company reference. Then there have been quite a lot of changes in terms of providing for existing practices. So, from what I understand, the law has not really provided for getting information from foreign supervisors or foreign staff.
Now, this is there are really two ways that a foreign bank can do banking business in South Africa. One is through the registration of a branch. The other is to incorporate as a company. The branch regulations provide a whole list of information that the bank has to provide when it operates as a branch. But there's a gap that when it comes in as an incorporated company, the same list of information is not required. So this amendment brings that on par with what the branch regulations require. So do the banks that numbers require.
I think this is a particularly important section in the sense of, you know, the lessons from the global financial crisis, that we want to ensure equal treatment for both foreign applicants and local applicants. And then we're now on page 9, so actually going quite quickly, to ensure that we make provisions relating to the name bank also applicable to representative offices, which is a small change, but I think quite an important change, that if you're operating as a bank, even if you're a representative of a foreign bank, that you should at least be subject to the same rules regarding whether or not you can use the name bank. And then there's just a new provision in section 65C, which is relating to the objection period for new appointments. And then, as I said, so that's, I think, deals with some of the tidying up provisions. Then, as I said, we are regularly subject to reviews. Passive review is a Financial Action Task Force review. The Financial Action Task Force was a body set up following the September 2001 World Trade Center attacks, and it is designed to ensure that to deal with counter-terrorism financing and anti-money laundering. And one of the key outcomes of that process was to introduce the Financial Intelligence Center Act, the FICA Act, and that has required, they come and review whether or not South Africa's system of counter-finance terrorism and anti-money laundering is the same as, or is aligned with international standards, and their review has made only one small change recommendation, which is that a material of contravention of FICA is ground for deregistration of the bank, and it is required that to introduce a new section 23.2. And then, as I indicated, the International Monetary Fund and World Bank came and did a number of assessments over the course of the last 5 years, and they have made some proposals to improve our system of particularly curatorship, and that regards two areas. One is the process that needs to be followed, and there was a concern in terms of international standards in terms of the process of cancelling of registration. There is a view that registration should be cancelled early after consultation with the minister, because there can be delays that can develop between the supervisor and the minister, and so they have proposed that we slightly soften the registration requirements. And then also discretion to suspend registration pending decision to deregister. And then one of the more interesting ones is the idea that we previously had, which was the law previously used to say, that if you decide to put a bank into curatorship, that you need to actually get the written consent of the CEO or the chair, and obviously this can become a very difficult process if there is a huge disagreement in the process. And so we have proposed that, and this was actually an IMA proposal in line with international standards, that curatorship should be with the notification of the chair and the CEO of the relevant bank. And in line with ensuring that this takes place as relatively smoothly as possible, the notification is by the governor of the bank. and so they can notify the person in writing. Then there were certain industry developments, obviously, which have taken place over the last 4 years. And one particularly relates to the acquisition and the expansion of banks outside of South Africa. And we are obviously strongly in favor of this, but we are only in favor of it if it does not bring risk to the South African financial system. So perhaps, Michael, if you can explain the new Section 52 proposals around the expansion of banks.
Yeah, okay. As Roy said, that obviously we want to see where banks are going with the expansion, but there are certain instances where they acquire certain offshore companies as security for loans granted. And when those loans aren't repaid, suddenly they have that security come onto their, into their structure. Now, in those cases, we believe that they can notify us only that a proper application prior to acquisition is not required. But we will be able to issue a directive. All this is saying is to enable the registrar to issue a directive to say under which circumstances will it be allowed to only a notification will be sufficient and not a prior written application. So it's an enabler only.
Thank you very much. Look, then one of the most interesting things, I think, for us that has come out of the global financial crisis is this concept that the bonus structures of banks can actually drive the wrong types of behavior. So, once again, it has been something driven quite strongly by the then-president, Sarkozy of France, who made it, I think, an election platform to bring down banks' bonuses, and it is something that is still an issue. And their concern was that the structure of how bankers are remunerated and the bonus structure that they receive could actually have the unintended consequence of driving short-term risky behavior. So basically, you get a big bonus if you give out a risky loan. And obviously, this is quite a big concern, particularly because many banks have attentive structures which are obviously strong performance-based. So over the last few years, the registrar has put in place quite an extensive system to prevent this, and it was a flavor of the topic of the year 2 years ago, 3 years ago. So this is not a new thing at all. We have over the last while been quite, the registrar has been quite strong in terms of ensuring that the way bankers' bonuses are paid are in line with good practices in terms of reducing risk. But that does require us to introduce a new section to the law, and that is Section 64C, which establishes a remuneration committee in law and gives it a certain set of composition and duties of the remuneration committee. And essentially that is to ensure that remuneration is done, or the decisions around remuneration are done as independently as possible from the management of the bank. Okay, then the next part is Section 84, which are just small changes to deal with the inspection of unregistered persons. I think this is quite an important section in the context of a number of the scams and Ponzi schemes that have been around over the last little while. And perhaps Martin can give us some idea of the process that Banks Division has followed with these and how this will help us.
Just shortly, the flip side of a system of registration to register a bank, regulate and supervise a bank, comes at considerable cost. So obviously, the flip side of it is not to allow other persons not registered as banks to do banking business. In order for us then to control those illegal activities, we react to complaints from the general public and others. We appoint inspectors to investigate whether the scheme is in fact illegal deposit taking. Once we are satisfied that it is, we close the scheme, we direct the scheme to repay whatever funds are available, and in order for us to have comfort that the funds are indeed repaid, we appoint currently all those persons managers, but it has created confusion as members of the public if you think that those managers are now managing the company or that scheme, which is not so, they're really just managing the repayment process. So we thought that a change of name should probably alleviate that confusion and rather replace manager with repayment administrator. So that is all that this person has to do. And that is the proposal to amend the act in that respect. So, yes, the only thing that that the registrar may do, once he directs, satisfied that if a scheme has convened the bank act, it may direct that scheme to repay the funds. But in the recent past, we have come across certain proposals to have an alternative way of repaying, such as the business rescue, the Section 311 scheme arrangement, and we thought just to have clarity in the Banks Act to provide that discretion so that in the deserving case, the registrar may say, this is a deserving case, I'm not going to exercise that directive now, I will provide you a reasonable time to buy an alternative repayment scheme, such as a business rescue for a 311 that's sanctioned by a court of law.
I think, Chair, that's quite important. These are quite important provisions in the context. I think a lot of discussions we've had in terms of the closing down of pharmacy schemes and illegal schemes. It's quite interesting to me always that the Bank Act is actually a very useful piece of legislation in terms of that, because often these are basically bank-like. And I think it's been quite successful in the recent past in terms of dealing with them through the Bank Act and then through our other pieces of legislation. Particularly from the Financial Services Board. So we've been quite good at combined process to deal with these sorts of schemes. And then the final one, a very small one, is to introduce a limitation of liability to trust. We aren't making very much of a change here, only including an inspector or that repayment administrator that is appointed to that. There's no change to the fundamental limitation of liability, it only extends to that repayment administrator that Luke Blackwood was referring to earlier, and to an inspector that was appointed in terms of Section 84 of the Act. And I think that brings us to the end of the changes. Thank you.
That the minister shall table a copy of the report. We are deleting the lay, L-A-Y, lay. That's the first gravity. If then that is the gravity. We also deleted 14 days after receipt of such report. If 14 days were then deleted, it makes the minister not being committed to time frame. I would suggest that maybe the 14 days after receipt of such report was on just an omission, then it has to be brought back. If we go down to Section 13, which is a new section, I think it's using the Roman figures, it's number 2, it says accept. Now, I don't understand. Accept what? Accept is committed to and complies with the proposal guidelines and pronouncement. Is the acceptance of the pronouncement which has been made by the bailout committee, or is to accept the provision of the act? So what does the accept stand for? Does it stand for the accepting the pronouncement by the bailout committee, or acceptance of the provision of the act that we are discussing today? Chair, if you go into the bill itself, that is page 6, section 15, that the last point of the section 15, it says is committed to keeping the registrar informed of any material information. Now, committed, it really doesn't make them, you know, it doesn't make whoever is supposed to submit the information to the registrar compulsory, because he or she will only submit it if he does have a commitment to do so. If you can just make it more like it's compulsory that information has to be given, or any material information regarding the financial soundness of the foreign institution, it has to be given, rather than saying commit, that person needs to have that commitment to do so. If, last one, Chair, if you're going to section 23 of the bill itself, where you have on the subsection removed the with the consent of, and you inserted after consultation with the minister. For me, Chair, we are giving more powers to the registrar rather than the minister. Now, this registrar, he will consult with the minister. But then I don't see the powers of the minister in the cancellation or suspension of whatever licensing by this foreign institution. Now, I would suggest, or we apply our mind as a committee, as to if now the registrar, we just consult with the minister, and at the end of the day, the powers are remaining with the minister to do the cancellation or the suspension of such conditions. Thank you,
Chair. Just two questions. I would like to understand, you know, in terms of the Basel III introductions, the new categories of capital, will that change the operations of banks, you know, quite considerably, yes or no? And then the new Section 30, what was favoured by the foreign banks so far? Just to have a branch or to have incorporated company? And why? Why was the one favored above the other? And will the new Section 30, will it be more unfriendly for foreign banks to come here?
Is this idea that the curatorship of a bank can now be established simply by notifying the chief executive of the bank? Certainly for me that raises a concern around and might raise an issue with the banking sector around the strength and powers of individual banks. I think you only have to look at what happened yesterday with the governments of Cyprus effectively took a certain chunk out of every depositor's deposits and was able to do that through whatever legislation they have there. That has raised serious concerns in Europe about the strength of individual banks. And surely a provision like this, where we actually give significant powers for the governor simply to establish curatorships rather than working with the banks to get the curatorship established, that does raise a question about the strength and ability of our banks to stand on their own, which is ultimately the question or ultimately establishes confidence in the banking sector. the action by government in Europe yesterday perhaps raises a question about whether this is the right direction to move. I'm talking, of course, to Section 69. I'm a little bit confused about the next section on the list, 52, I think, Section 52, where you're amending the requirements for a bank to, I think you said, acquire security that they have to lodge with them from a foreign operation. I don't understand the potential risk to the South African banking sector if a South African bank has to call in some security from another market. Why is that even something that they need to go to the registrar for permission? Isn't it? Wouldn't it? The calling in of verifiable actual security would not raise a question over the soundness of a local bank. I'm not sure why they even need to ask for permission. And then on the next one, Section 33 of the Amendment Bill, the Remuneration Committee. I mean, couldn't we go even further? If I read the section, surely the real power of regulating or making sure that remuneration is linked to the actual performance is in the reporting requirement that you establish and in boosting the influence of shareholders over remuneration. I see what you're trying to do in that new section, but unless you add the requirement that reporting is boosted and that shareholders have more influence, I'm concerned that actually they will be relatively toothless. And in that regard, how does that new section relate to the reporting requirements and the remuneration sections in general of the Companies Act? Do those sections in the Companies Act apply to banks? Then this liability section, I'm not surprised to see it because every bill that comes before us these days, we're extending more and more liability to regulators and to the ministry or the department. I need better justification personally for why we are extending that limitation of liability, because it is something, as the Treasury knows, that this committee is concerned with in general, and we actually requested, with regards to last week's legislation, a report from our legal advisor just to kind of help us understand whether this extension of immunity, really, in many cases, to the action of regulators is actually justified. Then some general questions. What are the deadlines for Basel III? Am I being silent? Almost finished. What are the deadlines for Basel III? When do we have to get this done by in terms of those requirements? And I think that is it. Thank you.
Firstly, because I think if a bank is not Basel compliant, then it can bring risk into our system.
And secondly, if a bank is not Basel compliant, then there is this really odd incentive for banks to incorporate in jurisdictions where there's very little regulation, and then just to sort of create sort of arms of their banks in jurisdictions like South Africa. And then you can't actually have any way of saying to them, well, actually, we don't like it for the jurisdiction that you're coming from because you don't have appropriate regulations. But we have no way of actually saying that in the law. And so this section is trying to articulate the idea that you have to basically be a foreign, if you are a foreign institution, you're going to operate in South Africa, that you should at least comply with what is proposed by the Basel Committee. That said, I do understand that the language is a little bit odd in terms of pronouncements of the Basel Committee. What we were trying to do here is to say that the bank should try as far as possible to align with all the components of the Basel Committee's their guidelines, their proposals, and their pronouncements, and that they should be committed to implementing them in a similar way to the way that our banks are committed to implementing them, and that they should basically then comply with the regulations. I hope that answers the questions in terms of the pronouncements of the market.
Yeah, maybe I can just add that Section 30 really relates to what the registrar should be satisfied with if he receives an application for a new bank. It lists a set of 8 things that the applicant is able to establish as capital, etc., etc. But if that applicant is a foreign bank, then the registrar should also be satisfied that that foreign regulator accepts Basel, is committed to Basel, etc., etc., as these requirements relate to. So this is for the registrar to be satisfied of.
Yep. Thanks very much. And the third part of the question related to Section 13.7, which is committed to keeping the registrar informed of any material information regarding the financial soundness. I think that there's a good point there, that it might be a little bit too soft in terms of saying committed to. Maybe we should make it a slightly stronger language. But we can maybe come back to you in the formal response, when we bring our formal response, maybe with new wording to make it a little bit, how would I put it? Just don't just commit this stuff, make it a bit harder. So we'll definitely come back with new language in terms of that. Then there was the final question, I think, was with the consent of the minister versus after consultation with the minister with respect to deregistration of banks. This has been quite a topic of discussion between the Treasury and the Reserve Bank over the last year, because the IMF has proposed that even for curatorship, the minister, even for curatorship, so when we put a bank into curatorship, this goes to Honourable Harris's question, which I'll want to pick up on when we get there, even when we get to curatorship, the curatorship should be solely the responsibility of the registrar of banks, and that is international proposal. We had a lot of discussion about this, and we actually came to the conclusion that we have had one or two banks going into relationship, most notably Sambo, and we felt that actually it would probably not be appropriate that such a large or such a big decision to put a bank into curatorship, that such a big decision should not involve the minister. I think the minister should be involved in a decision of that magnitude. We know Sambo, in the end, we didn't lose money, but for a period of time, we had to provide guarantees, and there was some fiscal cost, although we unwound that fiscal cost over a period of time. And so the minister needs to be involved in that decision-making process. So for curatorship, we haven't had any proposed changes. However, deregistration of a bank in this particular case, or suspension of the bank, is a slightly different process, and it generally applies more to smaller banks. And there, we're not clear that the minister has to be involved in all aspects of deregistration. But this is something maybe we could discuss between Bank Supervision and the Treasury and come back with maybe a proposed new approach, which I see the concern of the committee, which is we want to involve the minister, but also we want to give the registrar some flexibility to take decisions under what are very, very difficult circumstances, and sometimes it may not be possible always to consult the minister for what are quite small things. So I think we will come back to you and propose maybe some new wording on how we would deal with that. However, just to highlight that for Section 68 and Section 69, which are the more significant provisions in this regard, there has been no change to the minister's role. Then to go to the Honourable Quinnock's question around the new categories of capital and whether or not those would change the operations of banks. Capital, our banks are very highly capitalized, much better, not highly capitalized, they're very well capitalized. They're much better capitalized than some of their European counterparts. And actually the change in types of capital, from what I understand, will have very little implication for the operation of the bank because they already have enough capital. So there is enough capital in the system for them to deal with the new requirements. The Blackbeard would like to add anything.
No, I don't think it will change the operations. As a whole, the industry is, as it is, well capitalized, even judged against the new requirements. There are certain individual banks that will need to come up with more capital when these requirements kick in. Maybe I can just say that already the Basel III has been implemented through a set of regulations that have been promulgated or approved by the Minister last year and came into effect 1 January this year. But there's a timeline for certain of the requirements to kick in. Certainly, a whole host of them kicked in 1 January 2013. Some of the liquidity provisions will only come into effect 2015, some only 2019, and it runs right down to 2022. So it's a whole list of requirements for the long term to make banks more robust, safe, etc. So there's a timeline, and it has been built into the regulations. The only discourse we have with the Act and the regulations relate to those definitions of capital and liquid assets that have to be on par. That's as far as I can say at this stage.
Thanks very much. And then the next question related to this new Section 13, which is relates to the case of a foreign institution. And I think the question was which process do they prefer? Do they prefer to be a branch or a subsidiary, and is this going to be more unfriendly? Fortunately or unfortunately, I don't deal with the individual applications. I think that's more of a bank supervision question, so I'm going to hand it one over to you.
Yeah, look, it's the same. It's a Basel II requirement, I think, that places an obligation on the registrar to make sure that wherever the bank that applies for a license in South Africa, wherever that bank comes from, we have to be sure that the regulator there has accepted Basel requirements, has committed to it, has it in place, and enforces, so that we don't have a non-Basel bank creeping into our system. So that's actually a obligation on the registrar to ensure that the foreign regulator complies with Basel requirements.
Okay, thanks so much. And then there were sort of questions from the Honourable Harris. I'll deal with them, I think, in order, beginning with the question regarding the curatorship of bank being established by notification and the strength of the powers. Again, that was quite a subject of discussion between the Treasury and Bank Supervision. I think just to go through what obviously is taking place in Cyprus, in that case, the system itself is broken. They as a country are basically bankrupt. Cyprus is fiscal position has deteriorated to the extent for a variety of reasons that they cannot service the foreign debt from what I can understand, and this has put on substantial pressure onto the banking system, which is what is generally the story of the European debt crisis, which is that there is a terrible interplay or circle of violence or terrible interaction between how the deterioration over the last 5 or 6 years of sovereign finances and there have impacted on the balance sheets of the banks, partly because the banks are very large holders of sovereign debt, but partly because the recession in Europe has impacted quite significantly on the profitability and the non-performing loans of the banking system. And so in a Cyprus situation, there is a whole range of different actors which now have to come into place. Because they're a member of the Eurozone, it creates a whole new set of problems that they actually can't basically use the fact that they have their own currency to support the system. I think that is quite a separate set of problems to what problems are that we're trying to address here with the changes to the curatorship of powers. The issue is not necessarily to give the registrar or the minister more powers. It's merely to ensure that the process runs a lot smoother and that we get to curatorship in the unlikely event of one of our banks being in trouble quicker. I think that's one of the key lessons of the crisis, that you don't actually want to get to the point where your banking system is in so much trouble that you actually have to, you basically have to nationalize the banks. Curatorship of the system would have served us very well in the one or two crises we've had, where you basically try and keep the bank alive for as long as possible. So you put in place a new set of management, and you try and, for all intents and purposes, run the bank in such a way that it can continue to meet its obligations to its depositors. And secondly, then you also are able to provide it with additional liquidity and capital to ensure that it can continue functioning. This is something which is quite an important thing to that you could do as soon as possible. And in actual fact, often, and I think Edward Blackbeard will provide some historical lessons, what will often happen is that this will be something that the management of the bank doesn't want to do for very obvious reasons, particularly if the manager of the bank has run the bank very badly. And so our feeling is that it is not appropriate that we actually have to get their written consent, the management, that we have to get the management's written consent to protect depositors. The feeling is that this should be allowed to take place as soon as possible. This is quite different to winding up a bank. This is merely a curatorship process, which is actually designed to try and keep the bank going without having to nationalize it. So merely to replace the management of the bank with managers appointed by the Treasury and the Reserve Bank. And so I don't think it's a very enormous change, and I think it's quite different from trying to from taking away depositors' money. I doubt we would actually do that. We have in the past actually, during banking crises, we've actually paid out depositors completely. Exactly, would like to add.
Yeah, thanks. I agree. This change was mainly as a result of the IMF in their assessments identifying a potential glitch where a CEO or a chairman may refuse. And then the registrar and treasury will sit with our hands in our head. So the IMF felt that we should, rather than get their consent, give them a written warning. And we tested that with the banks, and they were quite comfortable with the change, because inevitably in a curatorship it might lead to a change of management, because the current management may be managed the bank incorrectly or badly. So the first step of curatorship would be to replace management. And if you now have to ask the same management for consent to leave, you may not get it. So that was the recommendation we followed.
Okay. Then the next question relates to the risk to the South African bank system of securities from another market. I think I don't quite understand the question. Maybe you can...
Yeah. I think we're on the same page. Maybe I just didn't explain it incorrectly.
Yeah.
As Section 52 now stands, it's very rigid. It says that any interest that a bank acquires offshore, it has to have prior written approval. Yeah. But in practice, we have found, like security, buying security, it's impractical to get prior written approval. So this proviso now grants or affords the registrar the opportunity or the power to, in a directive, set out certain circumstances when prior written approval is not required, where mere notification will be sufficient.
So what I'm not quite sure is,
Well, it's to keep track of what is happening. If you don't have that tracking device, things might get out of hand. So you still want to know about it, but you don't need approval.
I mean, we have to remember that the global financial crisis was exactly the result of banks taking on risk from foreign, particularly U.S. So what happened to some of the German banks was that they bought mortgage-backed securities from American banks. I didn't inform the supervisor. I don't think the supervisor even knew the sort of risks that these very boring German small banks were taking on. And what these small German banks were actually buying were completely fabricated mortgage-backed securities from the Midwest in the U.S. Bring enormous risk to the German bank system, and as we know, actually to the UK bank system, etc., etc. I think it's very important that the registrar retain some kind of approach that he can at least know where the risks are developing. So, but we do need to sort of allow it to take place, particularly as our bank system gets bigger and bigger, to prove every single time likely that it's extensive. Then there was a question on the remuneration committee. In terms of strengthening the reporting requirements and boosting the role of the shareholders, and how does that relate to the context? I think that's a very good point, and I think we will come back, I think, to the committee with some proposals on how we strengthen the role of shareholders. I think that has been a proposal has been something that I think has been highlighted actually subsequent to the Bankman the whole process. Is that we need to ensure that shareholders have appropriate roles and voice. So I think we will go back and check what the Companies Act says and see if there's a possibility for us to maybe have a look at the section in terms of ensuring that. Then on to the question of liability and are we exonerating everybody from any liability ever? I think perhaps, Chair, if I can propose we wait for the report from the state legal advisors on the liability provision, so at least the changes to the Banks Act are done in a way that is consistent with what we are going through in the financial services general laws and rules. So that at least we have a consistent set of liability provisions across the different regulators. As I said, there is no fundamental change. This is a different proposal. There's no fundamental change to the liability either to the registrar or the bank. We are merely allowing liability for inspectors and those representative agents, but it is something which may be considered in consultation with the federal advisors.
Maybe I could just add that where this emanated from was from obviously these inspectors and managers that we appoint becoming increasingly the target of lawsuits or threats. And the question was now, are they covered by this limitation of liability? The legal opinion said it could be interpreted that any other officer, as you see in 9.3 there, they could fall under that. It could be argued that any other officer could include an appointed inspector or manager in terms of the Banks Act. But in order to get clarity and certainty, it was suggested that we put it in specifically.
Yeah. I think you don't put a situation where, you know, particularly in the wind up of a Ponzi scheme, for example, that the agent trying to wind up a Ponzi scheme could now suddenly face lawsuits in the future because, you know, there's something wrong. So I think we do need to extend it. Our Treasury's view is that I think the limitation of liability extension is correct, but I think we'll wait for the report. Then the final question is around the deadlines for Basel III, and by when I think we answered that question in terms of end of 2012 was the international deadline for the implementation of Basel III in terms of getting all the pieces together, but that it's a long process depending on what particular thread of work. So capital is over 2019, leverage also 2015, etc., etc. So you basically need all the legislative pieces, and then there are deadlines that you have to meet because you can't do everything in one go. So I hope that answers all questions. I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you.
it is a very good point that there is a fundamental problem with all countries. As you know, we grounded this quite in detail actually with the Credit Rate Services Bill, because we had the same problem there, and you have the same problem in banking regulation, and you have it in almost all regulation, which is that risks that that are introduced are often not within the power of your domestic regulators. So you can have foreign institutions doing things which affect your South African bank, but how do you make sure that that our regulator or our authorities have sufficient role in ensuring that those risks don't come into South Africa? And as you said, we do need to make sure that we strengthen those provisions, which we're completely happy to do. But I think we need to, and Herbert Blackley will come in a moment to explain, that there is quite a process and procedure that you have to follow before you can operate in South Africa as a bank. If you're a foreigner, you can either be a branch or a subsidiary or a representative office. And if each of those three categories brings with it certain responsibilities to the registrar, gives the authorities certain powers, and ensures that they are subject to South African law, as I think they should be. So perhaps if you could take us through those different types of arrangements and explain how they work.
Yeah, look, as Section 52 states, the rule has not changed. That if a bank in South Africa wishes to establish or acquire an interest offshore, it needs prior written approval. Now, I hear that that could stifle development and growth, but it has stood the banks in good stead. But they have complained. They said in practice, there are certain businesses they're involved in where prior written approval is just not possible, like having a subsidiary as security for a loan granted. And I've given a few other examples that I can't recall. So what we've done here is to propose an enabler. So the rule remains, if you want to obtain or acquire an interest offshore, you will have prior written approval. But if you come to the registrar and in these cases, it's just impractical. These things are not, we are not acquiring to hold it within our structure. It will be sold off to make good the loan that's not being repaid. So it will be there temporarily. Why should we have prior written approval in those cases? So we said, right, come with your proposals. We need an enabler in the Act, because the rule in the Act is very rigid. You shall have prior written approval. So this is to provide an enabler for the registrar now to say, in certain instances where you can convince the registrar that prior written approval is not required, but a mere notification will suffice. The registrar will then put a directive out and say, in these specific circumstances, prior written approval is not required. And that is all that Section 52 aims to achieve.
Yeah, I think it's useful to deal with the two questions at the same time, because I think the two members have different views, which is quite useful. Let's take the example of a bank wanting to acquire a subsidiary in, say, Togo, for a small country in Africa. As you know, in the budget we actually announced a whole set of new reforms which would make it a lot easier for our financial services firms and for other firms to operate in Africa. And the registrar, I assume, would probably be very enthusiastic about such an acquisition, because it would make the South African bank more profitable. It would also have long-term economic benefits to South Africa, etc. However, we know bankers like making profits and like taking risks. They may equally want to buy a share of a Greek bank, or they might want to buy a share of a bank in Cyprus. And in that case, I think we should have some procedure where we at least would allow the registrar to know about the purchase, or perhaps, as Michael has outlined, certain types of large outright purchases may actually be subject to an approval of the registrar. I think to ensure that we protect the South African banking system, I think we do need some system of oversight, at least for our South African regulators, in ensuring that the way our banks do business abroad, it doesn't bring substantial risks to South Africa. So, you know, I think when we're trying here, I think, to strike a middle ground which I think the banks have been quite positive about, that we've both balanced the need for them to be able to operate offshore without always having to run to registrar for a written consent on that sort of everything. It sounds like, you know, a school teacher, when you want to go to the bathroom, you have to apply for written consent. Sometimes, you know, in certain circumstances, the registrar really would have given that consent anyway. So what we're providing for is a mechanism for them to balance regulatory risks against operational making it easier to operate. So hopefully we've struck the right balance, and we're really open to taking other proposals which might improve that. Then to go section 84. Yes, the payment discretion. Sorry, let's find it. You can deal with that in a moment. Find it.
Maybe just to explain the position of the payment administrator, yes, currently called the manager. As I've said, once we receive a complaint, we appoint inspectors. Those inspectors come back to us with a report, say, this scheme contravened the bank act by taking in deposit illegally. We then try and close the scheme. We direct that scheme to repay whatever funds they are back to the investors. And simultaneously then appoint manager or managers to manage that repayment process. Now that's a statutory appointment in terms of the 84 of the Bank Act that sets out the duties of that manager, of that repayment administrator. If obviously they don't comply with that, they will face liability. All Section 88 is saying if they are doing their job correctly, if they are bona fide, if they are not grossly negligent, then they should not face liability every time there's an investor that says, well, I lost my money, so I want to claim it from the person that last worked with it. So there are requirements. It's not a blanket limitation of liability. You have to be bona fide and do your work diligently or with due care. But certainly there are a list of duties that system or that repayment administrator has to adhere to. It's stated in the Bank Act. It's also in the letter of appointment provided to that manager. As the KPI, there's no blanket. It's all temporary inspectors, temporary, as per tax, then it's ended.
Yeah, then Chair, I think there was a follow-up question, follow-up question regarding the notification to the CEO and chairman of the board. And I think, you know, from our experience, actually not in banking, but in other parts of financial services sector, is that what tends to happen with these institutions and typically a unit trust or insurance company or a property investment company is a very good example, and unfortunately hundreds of examples of this, where the depositors or the investors in the fund and the management of the fund end up having very different objectives. And you will find that the managers of the fund end up actually sometimes even stealing money from the depositors or the investors. And in that case, what should the regulator do? You know, the regulator should probably have a process in place where he goes to the actual owners of money, which are the depositors or the investors or something, and says, look, he's investigated this thing, and he's come to the conclusion that the managers that are managing the fund are doing a really bad job, and are actually probably maybe even stealing money, or maybe even running this bank into the ground. I think that's probably the best process. But when you're dealing with a really large bank with many, many depositors, and you find that the management of the bank, which is completely separate from the depositors, the depositors actually in banking don't even appoint the managers, kind of just get what they're given. You do need a process where the registrar can take action and can say, well, I think these managers are not actually doing the right thing. And we have had cases. I think Samba was a case where the management of the bank was not managing the bank appropriately. Obviously, it ended up creating a lot of difficulties for the bank, and the Reserve Bank had to step in and had to manage the curatorship of the bank. So it is quite important that you do give the registrar, or at least the authority, some mechanism in order to take over the management of the bank. It doesn't necessarily require the actual written consent of the managers that you are trying to take over. It's a bit like you saying, you know, we're going to take action against you for something that you have done, but you're going to take, firstly, we want your written consent to action being taken against you. Very rarely will someone say, yes, actually, no, I agree that action should be taken against me. You kind of caught me, I've kind of messed up all this time. Has it ever happened that we've had curators that have not? No, we've never had a case. We could add in a section that says, provided that it is in the interest of the depositor not to get consent of the thing. I don't know how to feel about that.
Yeah, look, we've never had an instance where consent was not granted by the CEO or the chair, but it has been under duress. So whether that's true consent is also a question. But as I say, this we've always been marked down by the IMF and the World Bank. When they come and they see this in our legislation, they say there's a potential problem. Maybe you don't have the correct tools to sort out a bank that's in trouble, and you might have a problem in future. And they've always marked us down on that requirement. That's why we've spoken to Treasury and said, what do we do? And this is a compromise to say the ministers are still appointing the curator, but not with the consent, with notification only, in order to at least comply with the IMF requirements.
It never happened in banking, but it certainly happened in other financial sector, which you can understand.
So the process when you're going to create or a bank, previously it was by consent, not by notification. Is there no court process whatsoever? You don't go to the courts and say, after you notify, then you go to the court and say, I want an order with regard to this. There is no involvement.
No.
Never. Not like in a country.
No.
And I think it's because the bank is a different company. It works on a very finely balanced premise. If the trust is gone, the money is gone in the bank. So it has to be a quick, swift process.
Okay, honorable members.
We should have incorporated a number of suggestions and comments from the committee. And I think the committee is beginning to forward very serious views and suggestions around this particular act. As much as they say, it is not as expensive and complicated like the previous one. But I think in so far as to align our banking system with Basel III and the new company act, it is quite clear that we need to apply our minds on this issue. And on that note, I want to say thank you very much, and then we'll await the next round of deliberations, and this we're going to go to the public hearing afterwards. We still have got enough time to interrogate with the proposals. Thank you very much. Honourable members, can we take a 10-minute comfort break? Assembly pricing technical challenges that have become apparent during the implementation of the Act, which is the money bills, pass a resolution instructing our committee on finance to review the Act, in particular to see where we can introduce the amendments in pertaining to time frames in particular and others. The second aspect of the Act, which is what we are going to be looking at, is the setting up of the Budget Office and the appointment of a director. In terms of Section 15 of the Money Bills Amendment Act, Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act, the Parliamentary Budget Office must be headed by a director, and the Act prescribes that the director must be appointed on the recommendations of the Committees of Finance and Appropriation of both houses, and it must be conducted in an open and transparent manner. The presiding officers, in looking into the actualization of this Act, together with the chairpersons of the four respective committees, both in the National Assembly and the NCOP, constituted a task team chaired by the chairpersons of both houses to look into the practical implementation of effecting changes in the Act, but also running a parallel process of how we actually fast-track the implementation of the Budget Office, or the establishment of the Budget Office. In terms of content, in looking into the amendments, technical amendments, Advocate Jenkins, who's here with us, is heading a task team that is looking into the actual amendments. And I believe when we resume from constituency periods, that's going to be one of our first items on the agenda, because we really need to move in terms of technical amendments and content in that area. So that's the process that Advocate Jenkins is driving. In terms of the establishment of the Budget Office, the task team, together with the presiding officers, realize that we would need somebody who would actually help us to run with the process from the beginning. And in that regard, looking into internal capacity of Parliament, we could not find a suitable person who can do that. We then asked, through the presiding officers, a government from the DBSA of Professor Jahed, who has been part of study tours in different parts of the country, different parts of the world, just to research on how these budget offices work and how they are actually set up. Professor was seconded here from May 2012, which is almost a year in the next few months. And we think he has done extremely good work in trying to just set up or lay the foundation for the budget office to come into existence. Several committees, parties in their respective formations in Parliament have had an interaction with Professor Jahed just to come and brief them on what has been going on. To this date, the project led by Professor Jahed has been able to outline and clarify the functions and scope of the office, design an operational structure, but also establish networks with external stakeholders and has engaged political parties and relevant committees. The top team, constituted by the House Chairperson and Chairpersons of the committees, we have reached a conclusion now and are satisfied with the work that has been done and has been accomplished in a very short space of time. And we think it will be important to ensure stability and continuity in ensuring that the work of establishing the Budget Office is not stalled. We then thought it was important that we should come to the committee to brief the committee and say and make some suggestions in terms of where do we think we need to go from here. In our view, because we really need to have some element of continuity in our ways, we thought it would be important to present before this committee who Professor Jahed is, even if we've interacted with him in the past, but also thought it would be important that the committee probably should consider, given the challenges and challenges circumstances out there, because this government is now coming to an end due to the structuring that is taking place within the DPS and so on and so forth. And to find somebody to continue this work is going to be very difficult. We should therefore recommend to ourselves or to this committee and other committees that Professor Jahed be considered by the committees of finance and appropriations in both houses to be appointed as the director of the budget office that can continue with the good work that has laid in the past 8 to 9 months for Parliament. That's the issue that I thought I should table here. I know I've not taken everybody on board on this particular matter, but I've tried to speak to honourable members in a way so that we could actually try to be more helpful in making sure that Parliament does have a budget office at the end of the day. Judith?
That Benin possess, but also the experience that it was in his lifetime. But also, you know, it would be faulty for us, of course, not to also acknowledge the good work that he's been able to do around the issues of producing more of the framework that we still have to engage with as the budget office and role. But the issues of, I mean, when he even managed to get the budget office launched, but also the functions and the networks that you also spoken about. So I think that I'm more comfortable with the issue to say that yes, let's release a public professor so that it does not exit. It would also not be fair for him in his life as well that you leave the person to act and do all this infrastructure. The next thing you release them, then you get somebody else. It doesn't show consistency. It doesn't show that we are serious about what it is that we want to implement, because the type of investment that went to was the professor, I think that it's been tangible and it was that. But Jefferson, as probably just a question from my side, the clarity that I want to get from yourself, part of a personal in the committee, to say that when we say we recommend that we get appointed in which financial year, are we saying this financial year, bearing in mind the issue of the PPA and its own plan that is going through in this financial year or the next financial year? Aligning that question with the issue of the budget day of what therefore becomes the funding model of the strategy itself. And as a finance committee, I think it's something that we would want to apply our minds, and if part of the recommendation sticks to that, I think it will make sense that we are saying we are recommending appointments, therefore this is what needs to be aligned as a process. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair. Is this not supposed to be a joint report by us and appropriations, and then we can bring out one report in terms of that? It will probably be more powerful. And secondly, you know, the last sentence of the opening paragraph is a little bit of concern to me, where it says, the appointment must be conducted in an open and transparent manner. Now what's the meaning of that? The meaning of that, you probably advertise, and there is probably interviews. I'm just concerned about that. Maybe Advocate Jenkins can assist us, but if we simply, by a report of this committee, not a joint report, simply just appoint today, we
might just open ourselves very much to criticism with regard to that. I'm just a little bit in doubt.
Political level, Chair, we need to lead by example. We need to guide the process. Our recommendation as this committee supersedes each and every person that will come as an individual or any other institution because we are providing guidance. A guidance that says we as the institution in Parliament, we might not be the best attractive in terms of the caliber of the person that we require, and precisely the one who has been with us for the past 8-9 years. But we must be grateful of the fact that he accepts an appointment from us or show interest or decided to stay with us for almost a year. Other processes, Chair, with regard to the openness and the transparent mechanism, that is a requirement in terms of our constitution. It's part of it. That's where it's done. Here we are an institution, we're a committee that is representative of the public. And furthermore, if other institutions or aspects of making this more transparent than it begins here, it must take place, and we have full confidence in the leadership that we have shown in the initiation of all these processes, because where you are as this fourth democratic parliament, you are implementing a decision that was taken long time ago. All other parliaments did not manage to implement this. I think we leave a legacy here where we leave an institution with that kind of an important expertise that is required in execution of our duty. I thank you, sir.
I'm sure you've got answers to the key questions, the open and transparent requirements. If you don't, I'm sure the legal advisor can tell us if he thinks we've complied. But I personally don't have a serious concern there. And then the requirement that the committee needs to recommend to the House, I understand what Honourable Kunov is suggesting. I guess it might make sense to do it as a joint report, but I don't believe if we submit separate reports that we're in breach of the law. And lastly, just to say that me personally, and I know my party, support fully the appointment of Proctor Head. He's an excellent candidate.
But as a committee on the Senate Committee on Finance, I think we need to take it further, either than actually saying we are recommending and saying yes, we are recommending he's proper and fit candidate for the position, since it's a scarce resource that we are looking for. But for how long the conduct can we then as a committee discuss, or for how long are we commending? Are we commending this candidate to be there for 5 years, or are we recommending to be there for 10 years? I think if it's for 5 years, it would be proper, because I mean, even us as the parliamentarians, we have the term of 5 years. Thank you.
In the appropriation, and he just came back to say by SMS that they have took a decision that they will follow the act. I don't know what that means, but that is what appropriations said they're going to do. So maybe we must find out what is the act saying in terms of this. But I don't know, you know, maybe there can be now a conflict between the two committees in terms of a decision, but I'm just reporting.
To say the portfolio committee on appropriations being represented by a particular member, we don't know whether that particular member has been mandated to relay that. And us now listening to a view of a particular individual, I would understand if the honorable member was saying his party is of this opinion, then we would understand. But for it to be relayed as a position of a committee, then it becomes a problem. It might not be the case. It may be. But if that committee wanted to relay that to us, it should have done the other way around. It could manage it in a manner that is more appropriate than this one.
As members of finance committee or as a finance committee, we want to move this appointment. The question around transparent manner and other things can be clarified at a later stage, but I think there is an argument, Chair, that we want to move that.
The first thing that I want to say is that we should all take into consideration this is a new thing altogether. The Parliament, there's no experience in this one, on this particular matter. It's the first time that we're doing it. The second aspect is that I think we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that we've already started building capacity through this government from the TPSA. My sense is even if we're to go any other route and the current name that we're discussing was to be interested in this position, the likelihood that the highest likelihood for him to actually make it through this process will emerge. But also, open and transparent doesn't exclude the possibility of headhunting. It's a normal practice. It's a convention that is accepted, and I think that's one of the reasons we can advance as a committee that we have granted. And the fact that we did not go out on public even for the action just to establish a budget office, it was a subordinate in interaction with a reputable institution like the DPSA, that will stand the test of time as far as I'm concerned. On the joint reporting of Standing Committee and Appropriation, it is a point that we should look into, but I think as the Standing Committee on Finance, we should have our own deliberation and come to a particular conclusion on this matter. I think we're following the right direction in this regard. The presentation that you have would be the same as other committees because, as I said, the task team that has been trying to manage this thing is the four chairpersons of the committees and the two chairpersons of the houses, their two respective houses, in consultation from time to time with the presiding officers. So I think we'll be on par, we'll actually find common ground at that level. The funding, the current budget, in the subsequent by the coming budget, Parliament has budgeted for the budget office. There is budget for that and that effect. So I think those issues, if we agree, the conditions of employment, whether it's 3, 4, 5 years, I think we should leave that as a process of engagement between the professor. If we accept, we still have to consult even further with him, but has already been consulted on this particular matter. Those are conditions of employment that him and the presiding officers can also take into consideration, and the report will come back to this committee. The principle is to have a direct cabinet so that all other things should actually then fit. Jenkins?
other legislation which requires shortlisting, call for nominations, I don't think that there's anything wrong in terms of our parliament is proceeding. All the commissions that you have. Parliamentary committees are open by force of the constitution, and I think this complies. I think there are other ways of having an open and transparent process as well, but standing it in a committee, discussing it like this, certainly complies in my view. The Act does require in subsection 5 of section 15 that the, as you indicated, chairperson, conditions of service has also come as a recommendation from the committee. At this point in time, we don't know how it will look after the Act is amended. At this point in time, it is still there, so I would suggest then that, as you said, this is something that we need to engage in further on. It doesn't track or make this recommendation any less valid. It acts as a first step to get a director appointed from there on, move forward into conditions of service, the period of employment, etc., etc. So, Chair, I don't have any concerns from a legal point of view or from any other point of view for that. Mr. Julie,
any thank you. The meeting is adjourned.